for Africa News tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The U.S. ambassador to South Korea said Thursday he is doing well and in great spirits after an assailant in Seoul slashed him on the face and wrist with a knife. Ambassador Mark Lippert was treated at a hospital and later wrote on Twitter that he and his family were deeply moved by an outpouring of support and that he would soon return to advance U.S.-South Korean relations. Witnesses said the assault happened as Lippert attended a breakfast and a man, police later identified as 55-year-old Kim Ki-jong, attacked the ambassador with a 25-centimeter knife. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Gulf state officials in Saudi Arabia on Thursday in a bid to ease their concerns about the potential impact of an Iran nuclear deal. Kerry arrived in Riyadh late Wednesday after holding 3 days of meetings with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif in Switzerland. The talks took place at a critical time. The U.S. and other world powers involved in nuclear negotiations are trying to reach a framework agreement by the end of this month. Syrian insurgents detonated a massive tunnel bomb this week under an intelligence headquarters west of Aleppo in northern Syria, triggering a blast so powerful the European seismologists registered it as a minor tremor. The explosion Wednesday ushered a ground attack by a coalition of rebel factions on the Air Force intelligence building that was eventually repelled by Syrian government forces backed by Shiite militias and fighters from the Lebanese militant organization Hezbollah. Pro-government militiamen and fighters from Lebanon's Hezbollah movement have been pressing an offensive in recent weeks to try to encircle insurgent-held districts of the city. This is VOA News. The United Nations top human rights official warns the fight against terror must not be used as an excuse to undermine democracy and human rights. In a major speech to the 47-member UN Human Rights Council, Saeed Raad Al Hussein said efforts by states to combat terrorism are resulting in large-scale rights violations against the very citizens they claim to defend. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad Al Hussein, warns that an overreaction to extremist violence threatens to erode the system for global security, which states built 70 years ago to ward off the horror of war. He says counter-terrorist operations that are disproportionate and brutal violate democratic norms and risk handing the terrorists a propaganda tool. In his speech, the High Commissioner cites a range of violations committed by terrorist groups, notably the Islamic State known as ISIS or ISIL, and the Nigerian Boko Haram militants. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
China has pledged to get tough on polluters and tighten enforcement in a bid to help clean up its environment, an issue that is one of the Chinese public's biggest concerns. It also is aiming for zero growth in its consumption of coal. China has seen massive economic growth over the past three decades, but that has come at a huge cost to its environment in the form of soil, water, and air pollution. Thursday, in his annual work report, Premier Li said that China will fully implement an action plan to prevent and curb air pollution. This includes measures such as upgrading emission controls at coal-burning power plants and striving for zero growth in the consumption of coal this year. Liberia says it has released its last confirmed Ebola patient, with no new cases reported for more than a week. A Chinese-run Ebola treatment center in the capital, Monrovia, released Beatrice Yardolo on Thursday. She told Associated Press she's one of the happiest persons on Earth today. The World Health Organization says that Liberia reported no new confirmed cases last week, for the first time since May of last year. Liberia must now complete 42 days with no new cases reported before it can be declared Ebola-free. A survivor of the deadly 2013 Boston Marathon bombings Thursday described the moments after the attack as pure carnage. Race spectator Jeff Bowman, who lost both legs in the explosion near the finish line, testified on the second day of the trial of Johar Tsarnaev in a Boston courthouse. Prosecutors allege that Tsarnaevs were trying to avenge U.S. wars in Muslim countries. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
an Ebola vaccine candidate enters the final phase of its trial Saturday in Guinea. If successful, a vaccine could be ready for use in 5 or 6 months.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawar reporting. Details coming up. Also in the news, South Sudan's warring factions are still not any closer to signing a comprehensive peace deal. And Chad's president is demanding the surrender of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Uganda, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, with less than 12 hours to go, South Sudan's warring factions are still not any closer to signing a comprehensive peace deal that will avoid United Nations sanctions. Martha van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa on options for South Sudan.
Little to no progress has been the main descriptor of successive rounds of talks to mediate an end to fighting that began as a political dispute between South Sudan's president and his deputy in December 2013. The parties came together again in late February in Addis Ababa for last-minute negotiations. 2 days of closed-door face-to-face talks between President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar only brought the men physically closer while they remained worlds apart on how to achieve peace. Even increased international pressure had no immediate impact when the UN Security Council Tuesday passed a resolution to impose sanctions in the absence of a detailed power-sharing agreement. Gideon Mabor, a civil society representative to the peace process, says it is time for new delegations because both sides have failed and both share the blame.
Both parties are playing a game of tactic role just to buy time. There is a belief by the opposition that if they will buy time, then the legitimacy of the government will run out, which is a very cheap idea. While the government is not moving extra mile to realize peace.
Security arrangements have always been the main point of contention, with the opposition rejecting an immediate reintegration of rebel soldiers back into the armed forces. They want more time for trust building between the soldiers. And then there is the structure of government, specifically whether or not a vice president with executive powers will be installed. The two parties also haven't agreed yet on the principles of implementing federalism in South Sudan. IGAD, the regional mediation body, has only been able to induce repeated ceasefires, which have been quickly ignored. Alex Rondos is the European Union's special envoy for the Horn of Africa. He says it may be time to add some outside muscle to IGAD.
But it will be complemented and supplemented by other actors in the international community. I suspect other African heads of state and other members of the international community will unite in order to make sure that there is a framework to be able to continue to arrive not only at a short-term solution to bring peace, but to work through the longer-term issues of establishing a country that is sustainable and viable.
The looming UN sanctions might not be limited to travel bans and assets freezes for individuals believed to be obstructing the process. Without a real deal, sanctions might also include an arms embargo. Solomon Derso is an analyst with the Institute for Security Studies who believes sanctions without a political strategy do not create the right incentive for those in the negotiation process.
What should have happened is basically for countries in the region and the international community to have a united political strategy with no opening left for these two sides to manipulate. That hasn't happened. And that's why they were able to create alternative forms like the Arusha talks, which enabled them to play one forum against the other.
A political rift led to a military split, and the ensuing fighting has killed close to 15,000 people, displaced nearly 2 million, and left another 4 million people dependent on food assistance. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
An Ebola vaccine candidate enters the final phase of its trial Saturday in Guinea. If successful, a vaccine could be ready for use in 5 or 6 months. VOA's Jody Kapawa has the story.
The VSV Ebola vaccine was developed by Canada's Public Health Agency. World Health Organization vaccine expert Dr. Marie-Pierre Preziosi says Phase 3 will be conducted in the Bas-Guinea region. It had the highest number of Ebola cases in the country.
Phase 3 trial aims to test for safety and efficacy or effectiveness of a candidate vaccine. This is the final trial prior to licensure of a vaccine. The vaccination phase in itself is anticipated to last about 60 days. And then there will be a follow-up period of about 84 days, that is about 3 months. So altogether, it should be around 6 months duration.
The vaccine is based on a genetically engineered virus that's been given some proteins of the Ebola virus.
This is a very common technique to make good vaccines.
The strategy being used in the Phase 3 trial is known as ring vaccination. It's a technique that was used to eradicate smallpox in the 1970s. Researchers identify a newly diagnosed Ebola patient who is called the index case. Then they trace all of his or her contacts and vaccinate them, if they give their consent. The goal is to create a buffer zone that prevents the spread of the disease. Dr. Preziosi says it's important to have an Ebola vaccine, even though the number of new cases is on the decline.
Although we see that cases are declining and the outbreak seems to be waning, unfortunately, as we speak, there are still cases in various locations in Guinea. So this really tells us that the epidemic is not over. We need to continue because this environment is quite unpredictable and the epidemic might flare up again. And also, if we are able to have an effective vaccine, it would be really an invaluable tool to fight this outbreak and any other outbreak that would come in the future.
She says a vaccine could be used in several ways in the next Ebola outbreak. For example, it could be given only to frontline workers, those in direct contact with patients, or given to large portions of a country's population.
We are all holding our breath because we are living a very important moment for this outbreak and for any future outbreak.
It's not clear what the cost of an Ebola vaccine dose will be. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says Liberia has gone a week without reporting any new cases of Ebola. The country now has the lowest number of cases in the last 10 months. WHO spokesman Gregory Hall says that's good news for Liberia, but warns that Ebola is not beaten until all three affected countries reach zero new cases. He says the populations of Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone are so mobile, WHO considers them one country as far as Ebola is concerned. Health officials say there were 132 new cases in Guinea and Sierra Leone last week, an increase of 99 cases from the previous week. The World Health Organization says there have been nearly 24,000 Ebola cases since the outbreak began and nearly 9,800 deaths. Chad's president is demanding the surrender of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. President Idris Deby says he believes the shadowy leader of Boko Haram was in Dikwa 2 days ago. Mr. Deby says Shekau escaped, but we know where he is. He says Shekau must turn himself in or face death. 4 days ago, Chadian troops surrounded and retook Dikwa, a Nigerian city on Lake Chad that was occupied by Boko Haram for several weeks. Most of the residents had left the town earlier, but Chad forces said an estimated 200 civilians lay dead in the streets in the wake of Boko Haram's evacuation of the town. Chadian troops entered Nigeria a month ago to aid the Nigerian military. In 6 years, the Boko Haram insurgency has attacked villages, towns, cities, and Nigerian military camps in 3 northwestern states. About 1.5 million Nigerians have fled their homes during 6 years of Boko Haram assaults in northern Nigeria. Many of the refugees have made their way to Yola, the capital of Adamawa State, near the Cameroon border. So far, the city remains a secure haven against the violence. But internally displaced people have doubled the population of Yola with more than 400,000 arrivals. The 10-year-old American University of Nigeria plays a central role in feeding the many of Yola's displaced. The president of the university, Margi Ensign, told VOA's David Arnold how the city, the churches, and students care for their neighbors.
Well, our best estimate is that there are close to 400,000 internally displaced people in Yola. We know where people have fled, from which villages, and the population of those where they all left. The majority are living with us in the community, and that's what sets us apart, as far as I understand, from other crises like this. Only about 15,000 are in the government-run camps, and that's what the government takes care of in terms of food. The rest are with us in the community and living with community members. I can give you an example. One of the University of Nigeria's drivers has 50 people living with him. So the numbers are big. We are peaceful, however. Yola has remained peaceful, but the university and the Adamawa Peace Initiative that we founded 3 years ago has been taking care of, you know, hundreds of thousands of hungry people.
Are all of these people victims of the violence created by Boko Haram?
Yes, they are all people who have fled their villages because of either the threat of Boko Haram or Boko Haram has taken over their village.
And the villages you describe, are they all in Adamawa?
No, they're not all in Adamawa. They're in Borno and Yobe, the other two states that are also in a state of emergency. Mubi is in Adamawa, and that was one of the big ones that actually fell to Boko Haram in the fall. The army has taken it back, but as far as we can tell, there are not too many people that have gone back to Mubi. Adamawa State University, with 20,000 students, is in Mubi, and they're unable to open because of the damage their university sustained. So actually Monday, we're beginning to take some of their seniors on my campus so that they can graduate.
And what's the enrollment of your campus?
We have about 1,500 students. We also have a primary school, which is elementary, a secondary school, so a little bit bigger when you put all of that together. And so in total, we're about 3,000 people.
And the history of the school is rather short, as I understand it.
Well, we're 10 years old. We actually have a strong American connection. The man who founded the university, who was orphaned not far from the town, had American Peace Corps teachers in the 60s, and they really inspired him so much that when he went on and had made some money from his businesses, he decided to start an American-style university. So we really have an American heritage.
Can you tell me a little bit about the role the students have had in feeding the people?
Everyone at the university, faculty, staff, and students, have been involved in these food distributions. At St. Teresa's Catholic Cathedral, which is a huge cathedral, the bishop there has almost 3,000 people living on the ground, both Muslim and Christian. Everything that we do here is interfaith, and I think that message is important. But he has about 3,000 right living on the grounds of the cathedral. And then he and we take care of another 30,000 that are kind of under his care, living with his parishioners. I'm so proud of our students. Our student government president, a young man named Joseph, I think he's attended every food distribution. They're really seeing firsthand some of the challenges facing their country. And it fits with our mission. Our mission is to be a development university and to try to help solve at least the problems that we can in our communities.
What percentage of your college population is involved in the food distribution?
Gosh, I would say almost half of them have come at one time or another. We do 3 to 4 distributions a week, so there are plenty of opportunities for them to volunteer, but a very large percentage are involved. I'm not exactly sure what the future is. The elections are on March 28th. The Army is beginning to gain some ground finally and take cities back. So the most hopeful scenario is that people are allowed to go home, particularly in time for the rains. This agriculture here is rain-fed, not irrigation, and most of these refugees are farmers. So it's really critical that they get home and get somewhere where they can plant food before the rains start.
That was American University of Nigeria President Margie Ensign in Yola, Nigeria. She spoke to VOA's David Arnold. Listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Twenty-one past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. With less than 12 hours to go, South Sudan's warring factions are still not any closer to signing a comprehensive peace deal. The World Health Organization says Liberia has gone a week without reporting any new cases of Ebola. And Chad's president is demanding the surrender of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. Hours before Libya peace talks were to start in Morocco, military jets bombed an airport in Tripoli. A spokesman for the Libyan Dignity Forces claimed credit for the air raid. No major damage was reported in the Tobruk-based regime's second attempt to retake the capital. UN Special Envoy Bernardino Leon is to meet with both sides in the conflict today in Morocco. Leon told the UN Security Council yesterday that resolution of the Libya conflict was still possible, but conditions within the country were deteriorating rapidly. A parliament operating from the port of Tobruk is recognized internationally. An opposing regime controls Tripoli with support from an alliance of militias, of Islamists, and units from Misrata that ousted Gaddafi 4 years ago. Also today, the National Oil Corporation said Islamic State forces overran and destroyed oil facilities at the Al-Dahar oil field, about 100 miles south of Sirte. Corporation officials say 11 oil fields have been shut down in recent militia clashes. Islamist militants claiming loyalty to the Islamic State also attacked and shut down the Mabruk and Bahi fields earlier this week. The International Fund for Animal Welfare has saved thousands of farm and companion animals stranded by extreme flooding in Malawi. But more than 90,000 animals have died and many more suffer from disease, hunger and injury. Lamek Masina reports from the flood zones.
Torrential rains hit in early January. Thousands of people fled the rising waters, while many animals, including cattle, goats, pigs, sheep, dogs, and chickens, were left to fend for themselves. Cattle and small farm animals are capital wealth of the southern Malawi subsistence farmers. They put their children through school and feed and clothe the family with income derived from their animals, hence the despair of so many who lost animals. Government statistics show that in the West Hit district of Nsanje, losses include 5,000 cattle, 38,000 goats, and 11,000 sheep, while many more animals remain vulnerable to starvation and diseases as floods continue to wreak havoc. Ali Dibandawe is a subsistence farmer in the southern district of Palombe. He says the loss of his farm animals has put him in desperation. He said he had 7 cattle, 6 goats and 7 chickens, but he lost all those to floods because the flooding of the Parombe River in the area where he was keeping his animals before they were flooded into the lake. Bandawe says the animals were a source of income for him, especially during the growing season when he would kill one and sell the meat to buy fertilizers and also pay people who were assisting him in his maize field. Abida Sidikmia is the managing director of S&A Cold Storage and S&A Beef Masters. She says the company has lost 95 head of cattle to floods in one of the West Hit districts, Chihuahua.
The floods have affected us in that the pens in which the animals stay have been flooded with water, and because of the dung, a lot of the young stock was drowning in their own dung. So even if we try to push it out, it's because it's not on a slope. We were still having huge losses, maybe losing about 5-6 a day.
Veterinary experts say there is a great risk that the surviving animals could suffer from flood-related diseases. To prevent this, the International Fund for Animal Welfare has begun relief operations in 2 areas of southern Malawi that have borne the brunt of the rains. In Insanja and Chihuahua districts, the organization has been vaccinating and treating farm animals against common diseases such wet conditions can encourage. Christina Pretorius is the IFAW Communications Manager for Southern Africa.
And the reason we did that was because these communities, the cattle is the capital. So the point is that they've had to abandon their homes, and in many cases the cattle just got left behind. And what happened, in fact, is because of the excessive rain, the cattle are now have begun to start showing signs of diseases and illnesses that are caused by excessive damp.
She notes, however, that many places are not accessible because of damaged roads.
It's incredibly difficult to get to many of the communities that have been worked because they are still cut off by floodwaters. And we heard some really sad stories of floods that came in the middle of the night, and people were just simply, the best they could do was save themselves, and cattle got left behind. And we had terrible stories of people watching their cattle and their dogs and their goats and chickens and ducks and so forth literally being washed away around them.
Minister of Agriculture spokesperson Tiwone Chowe told VOA the government is going ahead with vaccinating surviving animals and showing livestock farmers proper ways of constructing crates as torrential rains and floods continue, especially in southern Malawi. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Feast with your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. With less than 12 hours to go, South Sudan's warring factions are still not any closer to signing a comprehensive peace deal. The World Health Organization says Liberia has gone a week without reporting any new cases of Ebola. And Chad's president is demanding the surrender of Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau. Coming up, music from Uganda, and in our feature segment, the devastating effects of climate change on farm production. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sonny, I understand your opening serve is African tennis.
Yehiz, when it comes to African tennis, Zimbabwe's Black family certainly has a very proud pedigree. Kara Black and her brothers, Byron and Wayne, have all had successful professional careers. Kara, primarily a doubles specialist, has won nearly $7.7 million in prize money. And between them, her brothers, Byron and Wayne, have pocketed almost $8.5 million. Byron and Wayne, like their sister, are also doubles specialists. Now, at the age of 41, Wayne Black is excited to represent Zimbabwe again in the Davis Cup team competition. Reporter Michael Cariotti tells us more from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
Blake will make a return to Davis Cup tennis when he lines up for Zimbabwe in their three-day Euro-Africa Zone Group 2 tie against Bosnia-Herzegovina starting Friday. Davis Cup team non-playing captain Martin Zua has revealed Blake will play in the doubles alongside Matt Finn. Zua says Blake's availability and the early arrival of Finn will help the team develop their doubles partnership.
For them being here also gives me a chance to look at our doubles pair.
Blake is buoyed on by the fact that some players have continued playing Davis Cup tennis to the ripe age of 50, with San Marino's Vittorio Pelandra playing against Egypt in 2007 at the age of 66. Blake himself says he's going to take one game at a time, adding that all he wants is to win his matches.
Take one match at a time. You know, it's one Davis Cup match at a time. I wanted to win so badly.
Bosnia-Herzegovina are ranked 40th in the world, while Zimbabwe are in 74th position. The visitors' top singles players are also ranked far much higher than Zimbabwe's players. Dama Dzumbu is ranked 89th in the world, while their second seed, Mirza Basic, is in 199 position. Zimbabwe's top player, Takanyi Garanganga, who is based in Atlanta in the USA, is way down the rankings on 324th position, with his career-high ranking having been 288. However, Zua is not reading into that, boasting that the Zimbabweans are banking on history.
On paper, they're a better side. But I think Zimbabwe, from before, they've been causing upsets during Wayne's time or during our time. Beat Australia in Australia. So going into this tie, I mean, it's a 50-50 chance.
The Zimbabweans are hoping to go all the way in their group and gain promotion into the Euro-Africa Zone Group 1 next year. While in the past, Zimbabwe played all their home matches at the Harare City Sports Center, the tie against Bosnia-Herzegovina will be at Harare Sports Club. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariotti.
From Zimbabwe, Let's go to neighboring South Africa, where first-round action got underway Thursday at the Africa Open Golf Tournament. Playing at the East London Golf Club, Irishman Kevin Phelan shot a 5-under par 67 to put his name at the top of the leaderboard. Reporter Mark Tompkins caught up with Phelan after his round. Here's Mark.
A good week for you last week in Johannesburg, and you started well here.
Yeah, delighted with how I finished last week, and it's nice to carry it on to this week. Conditions were completely different to last week, but it was nice to play well again.
Does it test the mental side of the game, or you've got the wind blowing from different directions, various other differences in the course?
Somewhat. I mean, I'm quite used to playing the wind, but it's a completely different course now than it was in the practice. It was an opposite wind, so a lot of the holes were... there's almost no point in playing practice. It was good. I mean, McCaddy did a great job with yardages and stuff. We were well prepared.
Any one of the birdies stand out more than any others today for you?
Not really. I think I played quite aggressively, so I tried to get as close to the greens as I could. I think all my birdies came from within about 50 or 60 yards, so...
And I suppose having missed out narrowly on a place in the Open last week, the hope is good finishes and do it through the ranking position.
Yeah. It would have been nice to get that Open place last week, but I was happy with how I played and just try and keep plugging away.
Keep plugging away, Kevin. That's Irish golfer Kevin Phelan, who is tied for the first round lead at the Africa Open Golf Tournament. And Kevin was talking with reporter Mark Tompkins at the East London Golf Club in South Africa. English golfers Matt Ford and Richard Bland also shot 67s on Thursday. The golf action will continue through Sunday on South Africa's Eastern Cape.
Hi, I'm Shegu Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. Pro boxing returns to free primetime television here in the United States Saturday night when a big card at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas, Nevada is featured. The Premier Boxing Champion Series will be televised on both NBC and CBS, two of the major networks here in the States. It's the creation of Al Haymon, one of the major power players in prize fighting. NBC will broadcast the fights on Saturday night. It's the first time NBC has shown pro bouts on prime time in 30 years. Undefeated welterweight Keith Thurman will face former two-division champion Robert Guerrero, and former three-division title holder Adrian Broner will meet John Molina in the co-main event. I asked our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moeta, is this new boxing series a good opportunity for African fighters to break into the spotlight?
Sonny, this is the best time, really. We need to develop young, hungry fighters in Africa, and time for them to come into the U.S. now that we have television all over. We have the big fight. The fight game is about to blow up, Sonny, and we need stars from the mother continent. We need warriors. We need tigers. You know, this is the time. So if you're a fighter listening in Africa, this is the time to do it. This is the time to get up and go to the gym, work very hard, because boxing is back in the U.S. now.
Namdi, you mentioned tigers. What about the Lion Bogere from Uganda? This seems tailor-made for him. He's such a flamboyant fighter.
Sonny, he's on the scene right now. He's got the best promoter. He's ready to strike, you know. So the Lion from Uganda, ready to strike. And then we have some other young guys. We have King Kong Agbeko. We have Joshua Clote. But we need new young names. We need new warriors, new tigers, because this scene is going to get really, really exciting, that people get to see everybody on Saturday night or Saturday afternoon. We need Africa to be on stage.
All right, Nnamdi, let's talk about a veteran African warrior, Bika, the Scorpion from Cameroon. He's going to be back in the ring in April. Tell us about that.
Sonny, he's going to be on television right here in the U.S. against Adonis Stevenson out of Canada, Montreal, Canada. Homeboy from Douala, Cameroon, he can punch. You stand in front of him, he can knock you out. He can even knock out a cow. I like to see him score a spectacular knockout, and then he'll be back. Okay, he's now moving up in the 175-pound light heavyweight division, and this is on free television. The whole world gets to see an African who can punch, who will stand and fight. He will not run. So I like to see an upset with Sakyu the Scorpion Bika.
Is that a good move for the Scorpion, Nnamdi, to move up in weight?
Oh, yeah, because that division is so-so. You know, he's a puncher, and he has a puncher's chance. And if you stand in front of him, he can take you out. And he's fighting a champion that's not been tested, been protected. So I think there's a good chance of an upset right there in Canada, in Montreal, Canada.
Thanks, Nnamdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta, dropping more verbal bombs right here on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Galala. Great show, bro.
In pro basketball, Spain's Gasol brothers have been sparkling this NBA season. Marc Gasol plays center for the Memphis Grizzlies, while his older brother Pau is a power forward and center for the Chicago Bulls. The Gasol brothers were both elected starters to the annual NBA All-Star Game last month, marking the first time two brothers have accomplished that. On Tuesday night, Marc Gasol was the hero for the Grizzlies. He made a jump shot with less than 1 second left in regulation time to lift the Grizzlies to a 102-100 victory over the Houston Rockets. With the game tied, Gasol blocked James Harden's layup with about 6 seconds left to give the Grizzlies the ball and set up his game-winning shot. Marc Gasol finished with 21 points. In other NBA results, LeBron James and the Cleveland Cavaliers beat the host Toronto Raptors 120-112. LeBron scored 29 points and matched a season high with 14 assists. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the devastating effects of climate change on farm production. And next, the internet on an untapped market opportunity in Africa. But first, some music. Here is Blue 3 of Uganda with Akayimba Kali. Blue 3 of Uganda with Akayimba Kali. Paris opened its yearly International Agricultural Show last week, an event packed with farm animals, growers, and excited children. But the 2015 show highlights the devastating effects of climate change on farm production ahead of a major climate summit in Paris later this year. Farmers and experts from around the world met recently in the French capital to discuss ways to adapt agriculture to a more difficult and uncertain future. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports.
Bigger droughts, more frequent flooding, more devastating storms. These are just some of the effects that climate change is already having on our planet. And farmers, many of them small family growers in developing countries, are on the front lines. These farmers will also have to feed a world population that's expected to climb from just over 7 billion today to about 9.6 billion in 2050. For United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization Director General José Graziano da Silva, agriculture must become more sustainable, more resilient, and more inclusive to respond to climate change and to ensure that the poorest people have access to food.
Always the poorest and the smallest are the most vulnerable, starting from the fact that they are already in marginal areas. So they are the first that are affected by a drought or by a flooding. That are the, let's say, the current ongoing impacts of the climate change.
The FAO chief spoke at an international meeting in Paris looking at the impact and solutions when it comes to climate change and agriculture. The city hosts a major UN climate conference in December intended to reach an international deal to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Il y a aussi l'enjeu de la conférence de Paris.
At the agricultural meeting, French President François Hollande said the UN summit will not solve all the climate change problems, but it must at least give the world a reason for hope. It's important to define a global strategy to fight climate change, he said, and agriculture must be part of the solution. Evelyn Nguleka of Zambia is president of the World Farmers Organization. She told VOA that farmers are looking for practical solutions.
Because it is one thing just to send an alarm that there is going to be weather pattern changes. But what is important for the farmer is how is a farmer going to be able to survive? So resilience for us is a key word. And of course, that goes with innovations.
Nadjiru Sall from northern Senegal heads a West African farmers organization called ROPA. He said the Sahel region where he lives has been dealing with longer droughts for several decades. Sall said the Paris Climate Conference will be useful if it takes the problems of family farmers like himself into account. If not, as far as he's concerned, it will be a failure. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The internet is growing in many parts of Africa, although the economy is struggling in Zimbabwe. Entrepreneurs say investors are jumping in to lay the foundation for what experts say is an untapped market opportunity in the region. Pauline Ndiho reports from Harare about a successful web design, development and marketing company called WebDev.
When WebDev, a Zimbabwean IT startup, opened here just over 10 years ago, its founders never expected things would go well as they have. Hyperinflation in Zimbabwe was at all-time high, but perhaps one can argue that WebDev was at the right place at the right time, and it developed into a successful technology solutions business, just as Zimbabwe was emerging from an economic crisis. Today, the organization is one of the leading IT firms in the country. WebDev runs four businesses: Zimbabwe's first online payment solution, PayNow, custom software development, web hosting, and their most profitable venture is an online classified ads platform. Vusi Ndebele is one of the company directors.
Our target market is very much dependent on which of the businesses that we're talking about. We have
our largest public-facing business, which is the classifieds business. It's a double-sided business model. So our aim as classifieds.co.zw is to provide a platform whereby consumers and businesses can search for products and services that they need or want on the internet.
The value of the business generated online in Zimbabwe is worth over $500 million annually as internet penetration grows. Supported by mobile phone penetration, which is around 40%, according to technology commentator TechZim.
There are a lot of companies created in Zimbabwe that have an opportunity to reach out into markets because we had to solve problems here first because of not having those solutions available to us. I think the opportunity is huge, into the billions of dollars in value of business on the internet in the next few years to come.
The revenue comes from social network advertising, e-commerce, online ventures led by Zimbabweans and in the diaspora, and foreign entrepreneurs. Markets like Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya lead the way in tech business growth in Africa. But for WebDev, their focus is tapping new streams of revenue in places like Zambia and Botswana, where they can grow and improve the customer experience.
We enjoyed a lot of success when the economy could sustain the development of such big solutions. As the economic activity has kind of faltered in Zimbabwe, we're seeing less of those big projects coming to us for custom software development.
Independent economists say less than 20% of Zimbabwe's residents are in formal employment, and economic growth is flat, leaning due to shortages of electricity and capital. Many engineers hope Africa can jump to the front of the technology revolution.
I think for people that come in now into Zimbabwe and invest into startups, are able to invest into startups at a learning phase, but also at a very low cost.
Zimbabwe is currently rolling out its fiber cable, which is primarily allowing residents of the capital, Harare, an opportunity to connect to the internet. But the economic conditions in the country mean that the profits from the internet businesses are not likely to reach the masses for years. Paul Niho, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24-7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Wertinger, and our engineer, Carl Sterling, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abu Bakr Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including The Voice of America. Most recently, he has claimed credit for the kidnapping of more than 200 young girls from a school in Chibok and is threatening to sell them. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is also known to have used the aliases Abu Bakr Skikwa and Imam Abu Bakr Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate, or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the RFJ tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
With your ears on Music Time in Africa, your connection to the best Pan-African music. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, inviting you to join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC. Every show brings you the best music from across the continent. Old songs you know and love, and new songs to discover. You'll meet artists, too. Listen to Africa's superstars and rising stars in exclusive, unplugged interviews on the radio or on my YouTube channel. Search for Heather Maxwell, Music Time in Africa. We play only the best. Right here on VOA Africa.